listening to a podcast of a program produced in 2015 as part of Aloud, a series of dynamic conversations, readings, and performances that take place in the Mark Taper Auditorium at the historic downtown Central Library in the heart of Los Angeles. These programs are presented by the Library Foundation of Los Angeles, which supports the Los Angeles Public Library. To support Aloud or learn about the entire podcast collection, please visit www.lfla.org/aloud. Historian Eric Foner's eye-opening new book, Gateway to Freedom, The Hidden History of the Underground Railroad, focuses on New York, as the city itself was a crucial way station on the railroad's Northeast Corridor, which brought fugitive slaves from the Upper South through Philadelphia and on to upstate New York, New England, and Canada. In New York City, wrote the Southern-born abolitionist Sarah Grimke, fugitive slaves were hunted like a partridge on the mountain. From Foner's book, we learn that once the slave trade from Africa was banned in 1808, and as slavery in the North was slowly wound down, quote, an epidemic of kidnapping of free blacks, especially children, occurred all over the Northeast. And after the Fugitive Slave Act was passed, part of the Compromise of 1850, an escaped slave was never secure anywhere in the United States. 150 years now after the end of the Civil War, as it was noted this weekend in the New York Times Magazine, no federally funded museum dedicated to slavery exists, no monument honoring America's slaves. Perhaps think of Eric Foner's book as a counterforce, a monument of another kind. Gateway to Freedom brings alive the incredible risks and hardships so many slaves were willing to endure for their freedom. Eric Foner is one of our leading American historians, the author or editor of 24 books, including the Pulitzer Prize-winning The Fiery Trial, Abraham Lincoln and American Slavery. His other work on the Civil War period has also been honored with many prizes, including the LA Times Book Prize, the Bancroft Prize, and the Lincoln Prize. He is the DeWitt Clinton Professor of History at Columbia University, where it is very snowy right now. Randall Kennedy is the author of 6 books, including most recently For Discrimination, Race, Affirmative Action, and the Law, and his last visit to Aloud to discuss that book was very memorable and moving. He is the Michael R. Klein Professor of Law at Harvard Law School and a former clerk to Supreme Court Justice Thurgood Marshall. He's a member of the bars of the Supreme Court of the United States and the District of Columbia, and the recipient of the Robert F. Kennedy Book Award for Race, Crime, and the Law. Please join me in welcoming our distinguished guests, Eric Foner and Randall Kennedy.
So we're here to discuss Gateway to Freedom, the Hidden History of the Underground Railroad. What was the Underground Railroad?
Well, it's easier to say what it wasn't than what it was, in a sense. That is to say, there's a lot of mythology or popular lore about it. It was not a highly organized system with regular stations and very set routes and secret passwords and things like that. I would define it as a set of local groups scattered around the North. I'm dealing with the eastern section, the New York City, Philadelphia, up to Boston, Albany, Syracuse. Local groups, rather few people, but who communicated with each other and did succeed in the years before the Civil War in assisting a significant number of fugitive slaves to get out of the South and into the North and eventually up to Canada.
The subtitle is The Hidden History of the Underground Railroad. So why the hidden history? What's hidden about it?
Well, as Louise said, the book focuses mostly on New York City, although it, by definition, the Underground Railroad is connects different places, so it spreads out to other areas. But I think the history in New York City is particularly hidden. New York was a very pro-Southern town. Probably there are people in this audience who have either been in New York or have come from New York, and you know that we New Yorkers think of ourselves as a very liberal, tolerant, multicultural city. Before the Civil War, New York was very closely tied to the slave South. New York merchants control the cotton trade. New York bankers finance the expansion of slavery. New York public officials were very closely tied to the South and very happy to apprehend and send back fugitive slaves. So the activities of the Underground Railroad in New York City were often quite secret. They were hidden. In other places like Boston or upstate New York, they were quite public and open. So New York's role has really never been discussed in any significant way by previous historians, even though there is a significant literature about the Civil War. So that's really what I'm talking about hidden. This is a piece of this, a very important piece of a story which really has never been analyzed before.
Okay. You know, in your book, you say that between 1830 and 1860, some 30,000 to 150,000, nobody knows.
Well,
for
I
sure.
wouldn't go that high. Let's say 30,000.
Okay. Right. Well, you say from and well, to say why no one knows, and say right. You say that the abolitionists, both the abolitionists gave a high number, and the champions of slavery right. gave a high number for very different reasons. Why don't you
yeah,
explain
well,
that?
Yeah, well, nobody knows, obviously, because this was, by definition, secretive, and fugitive slaves didn't like to publicize their activities. But abolitionists tended, I think, to exaggerate the numbers to demonstrate the discontent of slaves, to demonstrate that it was a lie, that slaves were contented and happy and well-treated, and to glorify their own activities on behalf of them. Many Southerners also exaggerated the numbers escaping because it sort of fed into an image that the North was kind of plotting against the South, was conspiring to send agents into the South and run slaves off to the North. And as the sectional conflict intensified in the decade before the Civil War, you did have, I think, a lot of people in the South exaggerating this as a way of mobilizing Southern sentiment for a kind of disunion eventually.
Okay, let's use the lower number then.
Right.
30,000.
Right.
So, one of the things that's really great about the book is that you give all of these stories, very dramatic stories. I was saying beforehand that this book has many wonderful movies in it.
Okay, let's hope so.
So a couple questions here. First, you give a number of dramatic, you portray a number of dramatic episodes of escapes from slavery. Tell the audience, give the audience one or two that are particularly memorable for you.
Well, one that is not unknown was the story of Henry Brown, who comes to be known as Henry Box Brown, because he was a slave in Richmond, Virginia, whose wife was sold away to the Deep South, and this obviously upset him a great deal, and he decided to try to escape. But he devised this method of escaping by having someone else, a white guy actually, put him into a crate, a fairly small crate, and close it up and ship him to Philadelphia, to the anti-slavery office, sort of like UPS, or what the equivalent was back in the 1847. And this was very dangerous. He could easily have suffocated. It took about 24 hours, the shipment. Part of the way he was upside down. The box was thrown in a way. It was on a boat. It was on a train. But it got to Philadelphia, and they opened it up, and out popped Henry Box Brown. And he became a failure. Now, he could not stay in Philadelphia. Mm-hmm. As Louise said in her introduction, there was really no place in the North that was safe for a fugitive slave. Even at this point, and after 1850, it was almost impossible after the new fugitive slave law. So Brown went to England and became a public speaker. But Brown is somewhat known because he was an abolitionist speaker. More interesting, in a way, are the anonymous people who appear in some of the record and then disappear from history. But groups who escaped, one guy I found very interesting, Frank Wanzer from Virginia. Everyone's heard of Harriet Tubman. I think Harriet Tubman is the most popular subject of children's books on American history today. There's more books on her for children than anyone else. But anyway, Tubman was totally remarkable and unique in that she escaped from Maryland and then went back like seven times to bring other people out of slavery. And now, that was courageous, dangerous. Nobody really was going to do that except Harriet Tubman. But Wanzer did it. Wanzer was from Virginia. He escaped with his fiancée, who he married in the North. And then he got up to Syracuse or Buffalo in upstate New York. And then the next year, he went back into Virginia with revolvers he had acquired in order to bring out some other relatives of his. And he passed through Philadelphia, where he left his revolver with William Still, the abolitionist there, as a kind of memento of the Underground Railroad. Then he went up to New York City, where I find his records, and then back up to Canada. So that is a pretty dangerous thing to do if you're a fugitive slave, to go back again to run people out. And I was also very impressed with just people like a woman named Emmeline Chaplin, who escaped with her infant. Just think how difficult that would have been, to actually run away from slavery carrying an infant child with you. And she told her story when she got to New York, but we know it's true because in the Baltimore Sun, there was ads. Her owner put ads in the newspaper saying, escaped, you know, reward, escaped, Emmeline Chaplin with an infant, you know, $200 reward. If you can, and they used to say, if you can, anyone who can get her, that's what the words were, and bring her back, $200 reward. So you get these people and these stories of, and some of the hardships they face, where they hid out, dogs after them, all this kind of thing. And these are from the time. You know, they're not reminiscences. Reminiscences are very valuable, but they often can be slightly misleading. But these are documentary evidence from the moment itself. So really, you know, very dramatic and vivid.
You talk about fugitives.
Mm-hmm.
Like I said, remember, you know, between 1830 and 1860, at least 30,000.
Mm-hmm.
What about the conductors? So, I mean, one of the things that's sort of interesting about the book is your discussion of the way in which historians have over time discussed the conductors.
Yeah.
So why don't you talk about that for a bit?
This is what we call historiography. Don't go to sleep. It can be interesting. How historical interpretation changes over time, which is part of the study of history. You know, in the early studies of the Underground Railroad, which let's say around 1900 or so, by a professor at Ohio State, Wilbur Siebert, it was kind of pioneering at the time. He sent out questionnaires to many, many abolitionists, and they sent back information about the Underground Railroad. But he created a picture with thousands of agents in the North, thousands of them, and most of them white. It was like white. His image was a very highly organized network with, he even had maps, which looked a lot like railroad maps, and they were, you know, set routes. This is all fanciful. But 3,200 agents, almost all of them white. His image was heroic white people helping basically helpless slaves, helpless black people. What he ignored was the role of the free black communities in the North, which is really more people, more of these free African Americans in Baltimore, in Wilmington, Delaware, in Philadelphia, in New York, other places were much more active. There were white abolitionists, and they were very, you know, heroic in doing it, but most of the work was done by these free African Americans. Then you go to the other side, and in the 1960s, at a time of historians looking at black activism, black power, historians came along and said, no, there was no Underground Railroad at all. This is a total myth. It's just popular, you know, legend. And it was just, again, these free black communities, but which is fair enough. But what interests me about the Underground, these conductors, is it actually was an interracial organization or set of organizations. It's an example which isn't that common in American history in some ways of black and white people actually working together for a common cause and being able to do that. There was tension. There were, you know, problems, but they managed to do that to help these fugitive slaves. They communicated with each other. They sent people to each other. And that's what strikes me. And most of these so-called conductors or agents or whatever you want to call them, again, are not known to history, really.
Well, again, say a bit more about him. For instance, this guy, Louis Napoleon.
Louis Napoleon, my favorite, right. Louis Napoleon was a free black man in New York City, illiterate. There were documents there with him signing with his ex, you know. The sort of outpost I'm most interested in New York City was in the office of this editor, Sidney Howard Gay, an abolitionist editor in New York City. He published the National Anti-Slavery Standard there. But his office also was a place where fugitive slaves came and then were sent further up to upstate New York. But anyway, he had this fellow, Louis Napoleon, working as a porter in his office. And Napoleon was the guy actually who did the footwork. You know, he was out there at the docks looking for slaves who were hidden on ships. You know, one of the things we think about the Underground Railroad and the image that comes to mind of a fugitive slave, which is fair enough, is a lone person running away, hiding out in the woods in the day, traveling at night on foot. By the 1850s, that's not how people were escaping. They were using there were a lot who came to New York City on boats. There were captains who were perfectly happy to take money from slaves to hide a few of them on their ship and dump them off. It was a little sideline of business. Napoleon would be there at the dock looking for them, or black dock workers would notify him, hey, there's a couple of guys, you better come and help them. Or they would be sent by train from Philadelphia. William still there would send a telegram up to Gay's office, and Louis Napoleon would go out to meet them. So he was, I'd never heard of him before I started doing this work on the book. And but what's interesting about him also is, and you're a law professor, he was illiterate, but he managed to go to court and get writs of habeas corpus to try to get these guys, if they were captured, before a court rather than just being sent back immediately. And in one case, one famous case in the 1850s, the lawyer for a slave owner, you know, said very sarcastically, is this Louis Napoleon who brought this case, the Emperor of France? And John Jay II, the lawyer for the trying to represent the fugitive slave, said, no, he's a much better man. So this is just another one of these. So that's part of the hidden history. No one had ever heard Louis Napoleon before this, really.
Yeah. You've mentioned a couple of times now the Fugitive Slave Act of 1850. And as a lawyer, the Fugitive Slave Act of 1850 is of deep interest to me.
Yeah, sure.
And I think it should be of deep interest to anyone, particularly insofar as every day, if you listen to the radio or read the newspaper, one will hear the rule of law. The rule of law. Well, tell us about the law of the Fugitive Slave Act of 1850. What was it?
Yeah, well, let's step back for a second and remind ourselves that in the Constitution, it says that, doesn't use the word slave, but it says persons held to labor escaping from one state to another must be returned. Now, it's typical of many parts of the Constitution, and it's rather vague. It doesn't say who's supposed to return them, how are they to be returned, is there some legal process, but it said they have to be. So the right of Southerners to get their fugitive slaves back is in the Constitution. And Congress passed a fairly weak law to this effect in 1793, but as time went on, Northern states began to put impediments in the way of this process, or at least to set up legal processes that needs a trial by jury before being sent back. Or they would even say, well, no sheriff can arrest a fugitive slave, or they can't hide him and put him in jail. By 1850, the South was demanding. Now, the Compromise of 1850, as people probably know, was when California was admitted to the Union as a state. So, but part of that compromise was this new, very, very severe fugitive slave law. It made it a federal responsibility. It created a whole new set of federal officials called commissioners, whose only job was to judge accused or alleged fugitives and send them back. It said federal marshals, even the U.S. Army, could be used to bring fugitives back to the South. It made it a federal crime to resist this or even to refuse to help. If a sheriff or a marshal came to you and said, look, I'm chasing this fugitive, you got to help me, and you said, I don't think I want to do that, that's a federal crime right there. So this was draconian. It overrode all the legal procedures in the North. It invalidated Northern laws. What's interesting about that, of course, is, and by the way, the fugitive could not testify. The only person who could testify was the owner or the owner's representative. It was really just a case of identity. If a guy came with a deed and said, okay, here's this fellow who was captured, and here's a proof that I own him, back he goes. Even if he said, well, hey, I'm not that guy. It doesn't matter. He couldn't testify. So one of the interesting things about it is that we often hear that the South believed in states' rights before the Civil War. This was the opposite of states' rights. This was the powerful use of the federal government, a federal power, the most vigorous intervention of the federal government in local affairs of any kind before the Civil War in the interest of slavery. And it was northern states who tried, many of them had tried to block it, or even Wisconsin actually nullified it. They picked up John C. Calhoun's doctrine and nullified it, which the Supreme Court in Abelman v. Booth overturned that and affirmed the constitutionality of the fugitive slave law. So when you get to the, you know, so people were violating the law, no question about it. People like Napoleon, Sidney Howard Gay, William Still, others, they were knowingly violating federal law. And but that, you know, it raises the perennial question. What do you do when faced with an unjust law? What are the circumstances of civil disobedience? Is it now? Not everybody said you should. Abraham Lincoln, who was a lawyer and a believer in the Constitution, he wrote in a famous letter in 1855, he said, you know, I hate to see these fugitives hunted down, but I bite my lip and keep silent. Why did he keep silent? Because this was the rule of law, as you said. He believed in the rule of law. He said, you know, I think this law should be amended in some ways, but unfortunately it's the law and we have to abide by it. So, you know, the rule of law and justice are not necessarily the same thing.
Although William Seward, at the same time, invoked the higher law. And
William Seward, in the debate over the fugitive slave law in 1850, said, yes, there's the Constitution, but there's a higher law than the Constitution, which means the law of morality or of religion or whatever you want to say. Now, to Southerners, that was anathema. If this provision of the Constitution could be overturned, well, maybe what about other provisions protecting slavery? So, but Lincoln wrote, in my book on Lincoln, I quote this letter, which very few people ever quote, where he said, I agree with Seward on the irrepressible conflict. That is to say that there is a house divided, you know, that there's an inevitable conflict between freedom and slavery. I do not agree with him on the higher law. So they're, you know, and they're both Republicans. So they you know, that's a division within the Republican Party.
You said a moment ago that, you know, you said these are issues that come back.
Right.
True enough. So since reading your book, I've been keeping a sort of an antenna out for references to a person now who's Henry Clay.
All right.
Henry Clay, the architect of the Compromise of 1850,
right,
is spoken about, you know, the great compromiser. You have people from all over you have Democrats and Republicans right now who praise Henry Clay. But then again, if you go back historically, abolitionists wouldn't have been praising Henry Clay.
No, certainly weren't. Well, it shows you a little bit about how times have changed, that people, Henry Clay's brand name, so to speak, was the Great Compromise. Now, I don't think there's any political leader today who would like to be called the Great Compromiser, right? That's both parties, so that's not what they're looking for right now. But we tend to, our mainstream history tends to glorify people who tried to settle these issues. But the problem was, as Seward said, it was an irrepressible conflict. It was not settleable by compromise. Clay is interesting. I quote Clay in there because at this very time that Congress was, just before Congress was debating this, Clay had come up to Rhode Island, Newport, I guess, for a vacation with a slave, and the slave ran away. And Clay said, you know, I'm not really going to chase this guy. If our positions were reversed, I would do the same thing. So Clay was kind of philosophical about it as well, you know.
Again, in the book, there's so many poignant stories and testimony that is so heartbreaking. I want to read something from Harriet Jacobs.
Famous.
Was a fugitive slave. She writes a wonderful memoir. And this is in the chapter on the Fugitive Slave Act of 1850. And you have a number of pages in which the chapter is really dedicated to, you know, what did it feel like to be a black person any black person, whether you were fugitive or whether you were free, but any black person was under a cloud after 1850. And you quote Harriet Jacobs, and I want to read what she had to say. And she's talking about black people in New York. Mm-hmm. Many families who had lived in the city for 20 years fled it now. Many a wife discovered a secret she had never known before, that her husband was a fugitive and must leave her to ensure his own safety. Worse still, many a husband discovered that his wife had fled from slavery years ago, and the children of his love were liable to be seized and carried into slavery.
Mm-hmm.
Now, this is interesting on a lot of different levels. One, just the human interest. But there's a legal element here. Why is it that she says, worse still, many a husband discovered that his wife had fled from slavery years ago, and the children of his love were liable to be seized and carried into slavery?
Well, because, as you know, of course, the law of slavery was that a child would follow the status of the mother. Mm-hmm. This is pretty well known by people who study slavery, but we often don't quite realize how unusual that is in a sense, because in colonial America, 19th century America, actually children were supposed to follow the father. In divorce, which is quite rare, the father always got custody, not like in the 20th century, etc. The child sort of belonged to the father, but not in slavery. And there were many reasons for this, but one major reason was this meant that the offspring of men, white men, owners, and slave women, the owner had no connection to that. That followed was a slave, and followed the mother, and so the owner didn't have to take any responsibility for this child or anything like that. There was just another piece of property, but yes,
increased to his estate.
Yeah. But that quote illustrates a number of things. One is the Fugitive Slave Act was retroactive. There was no statute of limitations here because it wasn't a criminal proceeding. It was just identification of a piece of property. If your horse escaped, 20 years later, if you found your horse, you could get him back. There's not a crime involved. So people who had escaped in the 1830s and had lived peaceful lives in New York City for 15, 20 years suddenly could be seized and taken to slavery. And, of course, under the law, when she said many people fled it now, including free black people, because the law was set up that it was very easy for a free black person to be swept up in this. In fact, one of the very first cases under the law from Pennsylvania, a guy was brought before a commissioner, sent back to Maryland, and when he got there, the owner said, this is not the right guy. I don't know who this fellow is, you know? So it was quite, because they couldn't testify on their own behalf. Go back to the rule of law, it was completely weighted in favor of the slave owner. So the 1850s are the only decade in the history of New York City where the black population actually declined. Several thousand people fled New York City to avoid the possibility of either being captured if they were slaves or just being swept up as free people and sent back as if they were fugitive slaves.
You talk about this. You say that you devote a lot of attention to the fact that black people in the United States, particularly after the Fugitive Slave Act of 1850, went to Canada.
Mm-hmm.
And you say you have this phrase about Republican slavery and monarchical
liberty. This was actually an abolitionist phrase that they were. It is an interesting commentary on some ideas we have about American history. Now, particularly in New York, we think of ourselves as a gateway. I mean, in a way, the title of this book, although nobody realizes it, I realize it, is meant to be slightly ironic. New York City thinks of itself as a gateway for people coming from abroad, Ellis Island, you know, people fleeing oppression or seeking a better life. They've come through, millions of them, through Ellis Island, and that's, you know, that's certainly true. But it was the opposite for these people. You know, thousands of black people fled to Canada to enjoy liberty. This is not the image we have of the United States, a place people must leave to enjoy freedom, not come to enjoy freedom. So it's kind of, that's, and the abolitionists said the same thing. Republican slavery, the Americans were always, oh, you know, look, we're a republic, we're free, and look at all these monarchies of Europe, but here's a republic defending, you know, promoting slavery, and a monarchy, you know, Canada's part of the British Empire at that time, and yet they would not send him back. They would not, this was a, another point is it shows you how the federal government was so closely tied in with slavery. This became a major issue in Anglo-American relations all through the first part of the 19th century, that the British would not send back fugitive slaves. Whether if they got to Canada, some of them got boats and got to Bermuda or the Bahamas. And that they really poisoned Anglo-American relations in many ways. And the United States was always complaining, why don't you send these guys back? And the British said, no, we're not going to. It's not a crime. Being a slave is not a crime. You know, running away from slavery is not a crime under British law. We don't have slavery anymore, folks. So if they didn't, you know, a murderer who runs away to Canada is going to be sent back, but not a fugitive slave. That's not a British crime. So it does reverse a lot of our images of American history in some way.
The story of slavery is such a deep story. And one of the things that you show in your book is the way in which it really affected all sorts of ideas. So, for instance, in the very first couple of pages, you talk about how a physician, a very well-known physician, by the way, yeah. Samuel A. Cartwright, actually thought that there was a disease related to your subject. What's that?
Cartwright was a very famous Southern physician before the Civil War. Yes, he said he had diagnosed a malady, a disease previously unknown to medical science, which he called drapetomania, a disease making black people run away from slavery.
Yeah.
And I go on to say, Frederick Law Olmsted, the guy who designed Central Park in New York, but also was pretty well known for he had toured through the South in the 1850s. He wrote these books about it. He sort of quipped. He said, well, you know, in the colonial days, white indentured servants used to run away a lot, so maybe blacks caught this disease from them.
It is interesting, though. I mean, he's a scientist.
Well, this is race science. I mean, as you know, there were many. This is not in the book. I have a student who wrote a paper last term about Benjamin Rush, a founder of American medicine, a signer of the Declaration of Independence, and a man who was against slavery. He was one of the guys who helped to abolish slavery in Pennsylvania. But he developed a medical idea that blackness was a disease.
Yeah.
It was actually a disease. It could be diagnosed. It could be cured. You could make black people white. And this is a combination of a total lunacy but also a utopianism. We would no longer have a problem in this country. We would no longer have slavery. We would no longer have racism if we could just cure this malady that black people had. So, yeah, this is built into science in America at the very beginning for a long, long time.
You all have been listening patiently. I'd like to open things up. But before we open things up, I'd like to read one other quotation, which I found very moving. It's by James Miller McKim, and it's from the National Anti-Slavery Standard. And he's writing in 1855, and he is talking about your subjects, the fugitive slaves. And he says at one point, "These wonderful events now being enacted before the American people will one day be justly appreciated." And I really think that with your book, that day has come.
Thank you. All right.
The floor is open. Questions?
We have microphones for that, yes.
Hi, Mr. Foner. I'm excited about your map of Manhattan and the havens of the right. Underground Railroad. Do any of those buildings exist? And whether or not they do, is there an appropriate place for a monument to the Underground Railroad?
Interesting question. You know, unfortunately, in Manhattan, as in many, many other places, we tear things down rather frequently. So in the book, there is a map of sites that I mentioned in the book in one way connected with the Underground Railroad or another. And I think only two of them still exist. One is the home of David Ruggles, who we didn't talk about, another little-known person who I think, if anybody could be called the founder of the Underground Railroad, is David Ruggles, because he created what they called the New York Vigilance Committee in 1835, which was first set up to stop the kidnapping of black people and from New York City, but very quickly started helping fugitive slaves. It was the first organized, there were people who helped fugitive slaves before, but it was the first organized effort. But Ruggles' home is there, and that's, by the way, where Frederick Douglass came, right? When he escaped in 1838, got to New York, and someone took him to Ruggles. Then there's a home of the Gibbons family, Quaker abolitionists, who lived up on, I think it was 29th Street, and that home is still there, and in fact, there's a group trying to turn it into some kind of monument. And then there is a plaque at the foot of Chambers Street at the Hudson River, and they call it Frederick Douglass Landing. Mm. Frederick Douglass escaped, as we know, in 1838, and at that time the railroad didn't come through New York City, it didn't come across the river. You had to get off the railroad train in New Jersey and take a ferry across, fine. So David Blight, you know him, of course, great historian, is writing a biography of Frederick Douglass, and he was very kind to show me his chapter on Frederick Douglass' escape. So I said, and he says, yeah, Frederick Douglass came and landed at Chambers Street. And I said to David, you know, how do you know he landed at Chambers Street? He doesn't say where he landed in his book. And in fact, I've seen maps of these ferry things, and there was no ferry going and stopping at Chambers Street. And David said, well, there's a plaque there. I'm not criticizing him. There's a plaque there. So that's right. Well, I don't think he landed there, actually. He landed somewhere else. But what does it matter? He landed and he got there. So, but the larger point, there should be a monument to, I mean, as Louise said, there is no monument in this country to the victims of slavery. You know, there is no there is a monument in Luxembourg Gardens in Paris to the slaves of the French Empire. It's not a big thing, but it's there. President Sarkozy opened it, you know, dedicated it some years ago. We don't have a museum of slavery, although one just apparently opened in Louisiana. I was reading about that the other day, but there's no National Museum of American Slavery. I don't think there's any monument to the Underground Railroad anywhere. We should. Our public history is way behind the current study of history. You know, it reflects a vision of history from a long, long time ago.
Just one little footnote, again, to show how your story affects people. You mentioned Frederick Douglass. Mm-hmm. One of the things I think is so interesting about the book is the name Frederick Douglass. Mm-hmm. He wasn't born Frederick Douglass. Tell the story of his name.
Well, I start with Douglass' escape. Douglass was Frederick Bailey. He escaped in 1838, came to New York City. He took a train. I mean, he didn't run through the woods. He borrowed the free papers of a sailor, and so he had the right to travel in Maryland, and he got on a train, and he got up. 24 hours later, he was in New York City. He had no idea what to do. He was there. He was confused. You know, no plan. A free black man took him over to David Ruggles, who helped him out. But Ruggles said, hey, you are not safe here. The first thing you got to do is change your name. Yeah. So he changed it to
Johnson.
Johnson, right, Frederick Johnson. Very quickly, Ruggles sent him and his wife, who came up, a free woman, came up, married. They were married, and then sent him up to New Bedford, Massachusetts, where they were safer because it was a strong abolitionist movement there. And as Douglass says, he got there, he said, well, half the black people in this town named Johnson. So I don't want that name. So he changed it again to Frederick Douglass. So he had three names within about 2 weeks, you know. Bailey, Johnson, and then he became Frederick Douglass.
The man who, and you point out that the minister who married him
is another fugitive slave.
Was a fugitive Pennington. Slave and had also changed his name.
Yes, Pembroke to Pennington. Yeah. And then his brother and nephews escaped in the 1850s, I told this story, and this was one of the failures, one of the few failures of the Underground Railroad in New York City. Pembroke and his two sons, who got to New York, but slave catchers were, you know, the train made it a lot easier, but it also made a lot of easier people to follow them. And the night they got to New York, they were captured and taken before a judge the next morning or a commissioner and sent right back. And then the two sons were sold and never seen again. And that was the brother of Pennington, who had been Pembroke, changed his name to Pennington, who married Frederick Douglass. So you were not safe in New York City. There was no question about that. There were slave catchers on the streets. There were police looking for people. And you had to get out of town fast, and they didn't manage to do that.
Others?
You have to watch for the microphone person, yes.
Okay. What is the origin of the term Underground Railroad? And
yeah,
my other question is, because the Underground Railroad was so unstructured, how can you attribute certain efforts or activities of assisting fugitive slaves to the actual Underground Railroad versus certain people just simply, you know,
yeah,
on their own escaping and managing their way?
That's a great question. The first question is very easy to answer. I have no idea where the, nobody knows where the term Underground Railroad originated, actually. You know, nowadays you can do these digital searches of newspapers and, you know, some, oh, here's the first mention, 1838. No, it's, but nobody knows why or when. It actually is developed when the railroad comes in, you know, in the 1830s. But very quickly, it just catches on. By the 1840s, it's all over the place in newspapers, just as a kind of general term for efforts to help fugitive slaves, you know. And it's used in Congress. People talk about it. The Underground Railroad is doing this or that. I think your second question is very, very good. You know, we attribute a lot of things to the Underground Railroad as if it were a fixed organization, you know, with a chairman of the board and this kind of thing. No, it was not like that at all. But I think it's a useful term at least to suggest that these local groups did communicate with each other. Yes, you are right. There were fugitives who escaped on their own with no help from anybody and got away, but we don't even we don't have any evidence about them. But by the 1850s, certainly, these groups were pretty organized. They were in connect. They were in communication with each other, and there were not set fixed routes. But there were these groups which were sending people on from one place to another. So, you know, as long as you don't think of it as a highly organized system, I think it's useful just to have a single term to describe these efforts to help fugitive slaves.
One of the ways you were able to learn the hidden history of the Underground Railroad was you found this remarkable document. Sidney Howard Gay had kept a record contemporaneously of the fugitive slaves who passed through his office. I'm a historian. I was amazed that no one else had ever found this document. How did you find it? What was your method?
Yeah. By the way, thank you, Professor Weiner, here answering the question. That's another reason I said hidden, because in a way, the document that is based on, that this book originated with, was, well, hidden may not be the right word, because it was in the archives at Columbia University. It was in the rare book library at Columbia University. So it wasn't in someone's attic where I somehow climbed up there and found it. But unfortunately, or fortunately, Columbia's system of cataloging and indexing their holdings is pretty primitive. So nobody knew this thing was there, really. But basically, the story, as John knows, is that an undergraduate history major, who was also employed as our dog walker. So I saw her every day when she came to walk our Cocker Spaniel, Sammy. She was writing her senior thesis about Sidney Howard Gay, this abolitionist editor. She was interested in his journalistic career. His papers, 80 boxes, are up in the Columbia Library, manuscript library. So she one day she said to me, you know, Professor, in the gay, I saw this thing called Record of Fugitives up there. I don't know what it is. It's in box 72. You might find it interesting. I know you're interested in slavery. It's not relevant to me. So I put it, well, you know, I said, all right, I'll, you know, one of these days I'll look at this. I was up there one day. I said, well, give me box 72 here. And out came this, it's really two notebooks. In 1855 and 1856, Gay kept a record of over 200 men, women, and children who passed through New York City, fugitives. He interviewed them. They came through his office. He was running this place. He's a journalist. He wrote down their experiences. He asked them questions. Who owned you? Where did you come from? How did you escape? Who helped you? And he wrote down where he sent them. He even kept a record how much money he spent, $3.50 for a ticket to Albany, you know, that kind of thing. It was a remarkable document. I'd never seen anything like it. And the stories, as you said, were rich and really moving and fascinating. And, you know, normally when you, a historian, I think when you start writing a book, you start with a question or an issue you want to investigate. And you look around for sources to study it. But this was the opposite. Here I had a source, and I had to kind of figure out what to do with it. And I kind of started tracking things out of it. Who were the owners? First of all, I said, are these stories true? You know, and I started, how do I verify this? So, but yeah, you can do it. You know, someone said, well, I was owned by Colonel Hollingsworth of Hagerstown, Maryland. All right, well, let's go to the census. Yeah, there was Colonel Jacob Hollingsworth in Hagerstown, Maryland, owned 50 slaves. So he didn't just make this up. And then there were fugitive slave ads you could find in the newspaper for these people. They're advertising for their return. So, you know, you start, and then he lists the people who are helping them. You have a list of Underground Railroad agents. He could go back to the woman. He calls it Agents of the Underground Railroad. He has a page, and he lists about 20 people, both further south and further north. I started tracking all this stuff down. And then, like all historians, you'd start going backward to find the origin. So now the book begins in New Amsterdam, you know, 1650s, at least just one paragraph, just to make the point that as long as slavery has existed, people have run away from slavery. You know, fugitive slaves didn't start in the 19th century. People were running away from the Dutch in New Amsterdam. They were running away from the British. They were running away in the colonial, you know. But organized efforts to help them come very, very late. So this document was from, and by the way, I will say to anyone who's interested or teachers or just someone who wants to read something fascinating, it's now digitalized and online at the Columbia Library website with a transcript that I produce because the handwriting is sometimes a little obscure. But if you just Google Gay Record of Fugitives, you will come to the document itself now up online for anyone. So it's no longer hidden, let's put it that way.
Is there a record of the conversations or the deliberations that were had by families or members of families about who should escape?
You know, that's a great question because on the one hand, one of the main, when Gay asked people, why did you run away? Some of them said, I was tired of being a slave. You know, I mean, that was his reason. Most of them had a very particular immediate reason. The most common one was physical abuse. And the story, you know, some people have, you know, oh, yeah, I'm in Hollywood, you know, the movie 12 Years a Slave, everyone knows about that. Some people found the violence in that a little hard to take, but that was real. I mean, you get in this, these people told stories of real physical brutality. But the second most common thing was fear of sale or families being broken up, Box Brown after his wife is sold away. But yes, every time someone ran away, it meant breaking up a family. Unless it was a, now Douglas was a single man, although he had a free woman who was his fiancée, so she could come up and marry him. But it was a wrenching decision of who would go, who would not go. Sometimes families escaped together. Most of these people by the 1850s were escaping in groups, not individually. That's another thing that surprised me. But no matter how many people escaped, there were always parents or relatives or cousins who were left behind, often wives. And some of these were women with even children, as I said before. But there's not a record exactly of those deliberations. Although like Harriet Tubman, who pops up twice in the Record of Fugitives, she went back, one of the times she went back to rescue a couple of cousins, and one of them said, I don't think I'm going to go. I don't think so. It's too dangerous. I have a feeling my master's going to free me down the road. I'm going to stay. And so that, you know, she actually tells you that conversation. But some people told Gay, one man told Gay, I didn't tell my wife I was running away, but I'm hoping to get her out. But I knew she would try to persuade me not to or something like that, you know, so I didn't say a word to anybody. But so these were very, you don't have direct you know, transcripts of conversations within the slave quarters, but you do get a sense, especially when people get out there, always writing letters to Gay or to William Still, his equivalent in Philadelphia, can you help me get so-and-so out? Which usually they couldn't, of course. So it was a very complex decision running away.
Hi. As you tell this story from New York, I can't help but think, how would the narrative change if you had focused in Boston or Chicago, or even if you told the story from the South?
Yeah. It would have been a little different because New York was so tied into the South. You know, Boston had a much more vigorous and larger abolitionist movement, although there were fugitive slaves captured and sent back from Boston. Anthony Burns, 1854, a unit of the U.S. Army had to come fearing a rescue, you know, and marched him down to the harbor and took him away to Virginia in a ship. And Thomas Sims was sent back. But then there were rescues in Boston. There was never a rescue of a fugitive slave in New York City. There were, in Syracuse, a mob literally entered the courthouse and grabbed a fugitive and sent him off to Canada, violating the law, obviously. So I think in New York is a peculiar place because of the strength of pro-slavery or pro-Southern sentiment and the economic ties and the presence of so many Southerners. Thousands of Southerners visited New York City every year. They came on business, they came on pleasure, hotels catered to Southern visitors. They brought slaves with them. There were slaves on the streets of New York even after slavery was abolished in New York because people would bring slaves with them for a couple of weeks. Hotels, a free black person could not get a hotel room in New York City, but they would put up the slave of a Southerner who came with a slave along with him. So I think the picture would look a little different if you compared it to some of the... Now, Philadelphia is actually the place probably most similar because Philadelphia is very close to Maryland. You know, Philadelphia is just across the border, really, I don't know how many miles, 30, 40 miles. And there were plenty of slave catchers who were always coming up to Philadelphia to try to nab people. So there you had the same secretive thing. But up in Syracuse, for example, upstate New York, the Underground Railroad was totally open, totally public, no problem. The head of it, Jermaine Logan, himself a fugitive slave, advertised in the newspapers. He'd say, hey, I'm the head of the Underground Railroad in this town. Anyone knows anything about fugitive slaves, send them to me. He had fundraising parties at his home with fugitive slaves present. Nobody did a thing, no sheriff, no judge, no nobody did anything in Syracuse. So the atmosphere there was completely different. So it really depends on what the political context is for how this kind of operated. And then if you went further west, maybe not to California, this was not a slave state, but let's say Texas, slaves there ran away to Mexico. They're not running to New York from Texas, that's a little too far. But they ran to Mexico, and it became a major problem in Mexican-American relations after, Texas became independent, then part of the United States. Mexico refused to send fugitive slaves back, and then the American government was very annoyed about that and was constantly complaining to the Mexicans. So it operated in different ways in different parts of the country.
Is there an equivalent or a rough equivalent of the Underground Railroad in the world today?
You know, I was recently at a place where someone asked, in effect, that question, but a little more directly, and saying, what about, or raised this comparison, which I think has some validity of what, undocumented aliens in the United States. They are violating the law. They are coming across a border here. There are people who are helping them, right? There are churches and others that give them refuge. There are some people who are mobilized to send them back, right? There are other people who want to help them. So I think, without going too far, one could make an analogy between that. And there are people who break the law. I believe in this city, there were the Archbishop, didn't he say a few years ago, that we're going to give shelter to these people. I don't care what the law is. You know, this is the higher law again. We're not going to turn people into the police who have come to you, you know, seeking a better life. So the same, in a more abstract way, the question of civil disobedience, of violating unjust laws, is always around, you know, in some form or another. So the specific circumstances change, but you might have seen the movie Selma, you know, which has been out there. Martin Luther King was violating the law quite frequently because the law was unjust. He's a hero today.
Okay.
Cheating a little into your book on Lincoln, Fiery Trail, which I'm really enjoying.
Thank you.
First of all, on that higher law thing, going back to that for a minute, in your book, you also talk, I think, about Lincoln deciding that he had to ground the movement against slavery, or he had to ground the national consciousness in a uniting force, which became the Declaration, which is universalist, but not law.
Right.
So with the Underground Railroad, were people aware of that ethos of we're all created equal? I mean, did that play a part in it?
Well, the abolitionist movement, you know, and the Underground Railroad is part of the abolitionist movement. And, you know, most of these people are doing other things as well. It's both underground and overground at the same time. They are going to conventions, they're publishing a newspaper, they're sending petitions around. You know, they're doing many, many public legal things as well as this. So they're operating on both levels at the same time. And the abolitionist movement made a great deal of the Declaration of Independence and the all men are created equal. I mean, this was, some of them had biblical reasons for opposing slavery, but many of them said this is a violation of the fundamental founding principle of the United States. That's what Lincoln said in the Gettysburg Address, right? There's a country founded on the proposition that all men are created equal. And as you know, in the Gettysburg Address, 47 years ago, goes back to the Declaration, not to the Constitution, not to a law, to a declaration which founds the nation. But, the trouble is most people, everybody loved the Declaration of Independence, apart from George Fitzhugh, you know, in the South. I mean, there were some Southerners who just repudiated this, but most people adopted it or, you know, identified. But most, I think, white people at that time said this only applies to white people. Stephen A. Douglas, the most important politician of the 1850s, we remember him because the Lincoln-Douglas debates, but Lincoln became famous by debating Douglas, not the other way around. Douglas said very explicitly, Jefferson meant white people. When he said all men are created equal, he didn't mean Negroes. He didn't mean Indians. He didn't mean Chinese. He meant white people. And that's how I think most white people interpreted those words. The abolitionists were the ones who said, no, no, this means everybody. And because of the cataclysm of the Civil War and many other things we can't go into here, that principle is then written into the Constitution after the Civil War in the 14th Amendment. But before the Civil War, the abolitionists were a small group, and their claim for universal equality was one of the reasons they were very unpopular.
Last question.
There you are.
Forgive me, I haven't read your book, but I will. Can you briefly address, beginning in 1861 through the Civil War, how the abolitionist groups changed their focus with?
One could write a book about this, which many people have done. I think it's interesting. As soon as the war breaks out, the abolitionists call for emancipation as a way of winning the war. They remind Lincoln of the so-called war power of the president, commander-in-chief. You can now, the Constitution no longer applies, or at least you can seize the power of the presidency to abolish slavery. But I think during the war, and they press for the use of black troops, and they press for black suffrage at the end of the war, but I think what the character of the movement changes enormously, because before the Civil War, the abolitionists are quintessential outsiders. They are standing outside the institutions, criticizing the society, criticizing the political system, criticizing the parties, criticizing the churches. In the war, many of them become embedded in the institutions. They talk about the use, they want the use of federal power. They become almost lobbyists, you know. They're pressuring Lincoln. In 1864, many abolitionists even try to run another candidate, John C. Fremont. They become political operators, which to my mind actually is not, they're not very good. Lincoln's a much better politician than they are. But they identify much more with the institutions of the country and the national state than they ever did before the war. They kind of lose their status as these dissenting radicals. Whether that was inevitable or not, that's a whole other story, so I don't want to go into it, but it is a very interesting story.
Professor Foner, thank you very much. And just one last thing, just as a point of personal privilege, your book is dedicated to my students, you say. Well, long ago, I was a student in one of your courses,
and he actually got a job.
You were a great professor then, and you're a great professor now. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Randy. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Aloud is made possible through support provided by the Ralph M. Parsons Foundation, the National Endowment for the Arts, and Errant Fox. Additional support provided by the Los Angeles Public Library, the Stay Home and Read a Book Ball, and individual Library Foundation members. Media support is provided by LA Weekly, KCRW 89.9 FM, and KUSC 91.5 FM.